Sin and redemption are recurring themes in the work of filmmaker Paul Schrader, so it was a logical choice when director Martin Scorsese asked Schrader to write the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ. Scorsese had already directed Schrader screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. The Last Temptation of Christ is now out on home video. When it was released in theaters last year, it aroused angry protests by Christian fundamentalists who objected to scenes that portrayed Christ as having human desires and weaknesses. The protesters might have been surprised to learn that Schrader was brought up in a very religious Calvinist home. In fact, as a young man, he had planned to become a minister. Movies were banned by his church, and it wasn't until he was a teenager that he went to a movie theater. Schrader fell in love with movies, and instead of entering the ministry, he became a film critic, then a screenwriter and director. He wrote and directed the films blue-collar, hardcore American gigolo Mishima and Light of Day, and he directed Patty Hearst. In The Last Temptation of Christ, much of the dialogue sounds more like Brooklynese than biblical English. I asked Schrader why.
Well, Kazantzakis wrote the original script in a dialect so that he could be slangy.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, he felt the same limitations that anyone would feel in dealing with the scriptures, because people remember this King James English, and you can't make a film in Aramaic. So that you don't want to make it in King James English, because that's just certainly incorrect. And you don't want to make it in Aramaic, because no one will understand it. So you have to find some way to make it sound fresh. And that means you just have to bite the bullet and use vernacular.
Well, instead of live by the sword, you die by the sword, it's you wrote, you live by this, you die by this.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of the dialogue was changed by,
I see, uh-huh,
by Scorsese. And mm-hmm, I think, you know, basically, because it isn't in Aramaic, but it is in street English, it will always sound wrong. And in the end, when he's directing the movie, he's more comfortable with his version of how it sounds wrong than someone else's version of how it sounds wrong. So it keeps getting changed.
What was your version of how that sounded wrong?
My version was a little more poetic. It was a little, you know, a little more florid than his version.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're writing on the page, it's always a different thing, and you tend to write speeches, you know, and when you're directing, you tend to direct conversations. So part of that is the process in all films, but I have a memory that my script was a little more purple than the movie.
Was the screenplay toned down from the original version? I believe you wrote about two drafts, and then there were several drafts after that. Was the screenplay consciously toned down because of the controversy?
Not much. Certainly not because of the controversy. In the original novel, Paul stones Mary Magdalene to death. And that was, you know, Marty just said to me, he said, with everything else I'm doing, I just can't have St. Paul stone a pregnant woman to death. So, you know, that was like a toning down decision. And some of the sexual language may have been pulled back a little, but not any more than the sort of changes that are made on any of our collaborations.
Did you expect this degree of controversy when you started working on the film?
Not when I started writing it, because I'd come from a conservative religious background that was rather intellectual, so I was used to kind of intense theological argument. But then in 83, when the evangelicals blocked the film from being made at Paramount, we knew it was coming.
Were you ever the slightest bit concerned yourself that it might be a sin to write this way about Jesus?
No, I mean, you know, there's an element of anti-intellectualism in all of this. And just because you need the faith of a child to enter into the kingdom of heaven doesn't mean you have to have the mind of a child. And it is possible to be an intelligent, questioning person and still have faith. And if I remember correctly, the Protestant Reformation was about exactly this point. And there is nothing wrong with this kind of theological argument. And certainly this argument the dual nature of Christ is the most central to the to Christianity itself.
Filmmaker Paul Schrader is my guest. Now, there used to be a ban in your church against seeing movies. Does that ban still exist?
No. I think that they have made that a matter of individual conscience now. It banned what they called worldly amusements, which included things like card playing and smoking and drinking and dancing and theater attendance. And this came out of Prohibition days. And the ban was actually instituted in 1928. And, I once, as a child, rather impassionately queried my mother about this. I think I wanted to see some Disney film. And she said to me, "It doesn't matter. The quality of the film doesn't matter. It's the industry that is evil." And so I think that was the position.
Did you have a sense of what you were missing?
No, and I'm actually very happy about having missed all those.
No, really? Come on.
Well, yeah, because because you are imprinted as an artist or as a person by, you know, how you come to a specific field. And I came to films as a college student, and the first films I really saw or paid serious attention to were films by Bergman or Buñuel, Antonioni, Bresson. And that was my original imprinting in films. And my peers and coevals, you know, were imprinted with Westerns and Disney films. And when they say, "I want to make the movies that I loved when I was a child," they think about those films. And when I say that, I don't think about those films. I think about, you know, the kind of childhood background and about the films I first came to love. I came to films as an adult and then later learned to love them as a child. So it has given me a unique perspective and a unique place in this business. And I've never really worried about anyone doing what I'm doing because no one has my perspective.
What's the first film you saw and what effect did it have on you?
Well, actually, the first film was a Disney film. Was Absent-Minded Professor. And I snuck...
Is that the one with Jerry Lewis, or is that The Nutty Professor?
That's The Nutty Professor. This is one with Fred McMurray.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the one about Flubber.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, I snuck into the balcony, and I sat there watching this, and I was wondering what all this fuss was about. And then about a year later, a friend of mine took me to see Wild in the Country with Elvis Presley and Tuesday Weld. And I sat there, and I realized, aha, this is why they don't want me to go. Here's the problem.
And what effect did that have on you, seeing that?
Well, I had developed a mad crush on Tuesday Weld.
And did that make you feel bad?
No, it made me want to see more movies.
Yeah, so what made you so passionate about movies?
Well, you know, it was a very luxurious forbidden fruit. I mean, not only could you be a rebel and do something that upset your elders, but you could also wear the mantle of respectability while you were doing it. It was like having your cake and eating it. It was a rare opportunity, you know, to be a rebel without, you know, having to do things like break into cars.
You had intended, I think, to be a minister, and then you became a film critic, and then a screenwriter and director. Why had you wanted to be a minister?
Well, it was just sort of part and parcel of the background. You know, those were the most respected figures, and I've always had this sort of proselytizing urge, you know, to go out and communicate and convert, and so that was rather natural.
Do you feel like you channeled that urge into movies?
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty obvious.
One of your movies, Hardcore, is about a father from a background similar to yours, a Calvinist in Grand Rapids, and this father's daughter runs away to the city where she starts working in pornographic movies. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if your parents felt like the father in this movie when you left home and started just working in regular movies, if the movies were so extreme to them in the first place that it might have been hardcore.
You know, I suspect they may well have. You know, they've had to make some hard compromises over the years. So my mother's dead, but my father has had to, you know, in order to keep his family relationship.
Did they ever break the ban to see any of your movies?
I believe so, but it's not a subject that comes up.
You've been collaborating with Martin Scorsese on and off since the mid-70s. The first time you collaborated was on the film Taxi Driver. You had written the screenplay, and you asked, I think, that he direct the movie. And I think you wanted him to direct it after seeing his film Mean Streets. Right. What was it about Mean Streets that you knew was the right sensibility for the film you were making, Taxi Driver?
Oh, it's just a passion, you know. And also the perversity, you know. Someone who is willing to grab the thing, put it between his teeth, bite hard and run, you know. I don't want to use words we can't use on language, but someone who has the guts to do it.
Now, in Taxi Driver, your screenplay is about a lonely, alienated, psychopathic taxi driver. You've described the taxi as the perfect metaphor for loneliness, a man driving around the city in a steel coffin. And his alienation erupts into a bloody killing spree at the end of the movie, which he thinks of in heroic terms. He thinks he's helping to clean the city of the pimps and the filth. I want to play from go ahead.
What's interesting about that is in the film, he fixates on two women, one of whom he can have and one of whom he can't. And, of course, he wants the one he can't and doesn't want the one he can. And out of this dilemma, he decides to kill the father figure of the good girl, who is a politician. And when he cannot do that, he fails, he kills the father figure of the bad girl, who is the prostitute. And what's interesting, in his mind, there's really not much difference. They're both... there's these competing father figures. It's just that in society's mind, of course, he becomes a hero because one of them was a pimp and not a politician.
Sounds a little Freudian. Were you in Freudian analysis at the time?
No, subsequently.
Okay. Well, you wrote the journal, the diary for Travis Bickle, the taxi driver, which De Niro just gives a brilliant reading of in the movie. I want to play some of that, and this is from the record, so it's excerpts edited together from the film. Mm-hmm. So this is Robert De Niro over a score by Bernard Herrmann with the screenplay by my guest Paul Schrader from Taxi Driver.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in $350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. All the animals come out at night. Buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets. I go all over. I take people to the Bronx, Brooklyn. I take them to Harlem. I don't care. Don't make no difference to me. It does to some. Some won't even take spooks. Don't make no difference to me. Each night when I return the cab to the garage, I have to clean the back seat. Some nights I clean off the blood. 12 hours of work and I still can't sleep. Damn. Days go on and on. And they don't end. All my life needed was a sense of someplace to go. I don't believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention. I believe that someone should become a person like other people.
The tone of writing in that seems so perfect for the character.
I love that line. I do not believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention, which, of course, is what this character does.
Oh, precisely.
Every moment of the day.
And the next line is just the most perfect line about alienation I think I've ever heard. I believe that somebody should become a person like other people. It's just the perfect expression of alienation. How did you know, not being a psychopath yourself, how did you know the tone of voice to get for this? It just seems just right.
Well, I wrote that script in 10 days, in two drafts. It jumped out of my head like an animal. And so it was a really a cri de coeur. It was a cry from my heart. I've fallen into a difficult period in Los Angeles where I was living in my car and just sort of driving around, and having a lot of trouble sleeping. And finally, I got a pain in my stomach, which turned out to be an ulcer, and I went to the hospital. And then while I was talking to a nurse in emergency, I realized I hadn't spoken to anyone in several weeks. And when I was in the hospital, I realized that that's what I was. I was like a taxi driver. I was like this person who was floating around in this car. And I got out of the hospital, and I wrote that script, like I said, in 10 days.
Well, let's get back to the tone that you actually wrote it in. There's something almost Old Testament about the tone. Someday a real rain will come along and wash all the scum off the streets. But that's that apocalyptic sense.
Yeah, I really, you know, that was my first real script. I'd done one thing before. And I didn't know how you were supposed to write scripts yet.
Did it scare you that you were able to so authentically and so intuitively capture a psychopathic voice?
Well, you know, it scared me that I was at that place at that time. I mean, the person who wrote that script is long gone, and I don't even know if I would recognize him if I saw him.
What was your reaction when Hinckley said that he was he had seen Taxi Driver and he wanted to impress Jodie Foster by attempting to assassinate the president?
I was in New Orleans at the time scouting locations, and it came over the radio that this kid had tried to kill Reagan. And he was from Colorado, sort of a white bread kid. And I said to the person sitting next to me, I said, it's one of those Taxi Driver kids. And I got back to the hotel, and the FBI was waiting for me. And in fact, it was one of those Taxi Driver kids. You know, the film didn't create them. They exist before the film and after the film, and they attach themselves to many things. More. You know, it's just actually sort of rare that they attach themselves to a good film. More likely, they attach themselves to things like advertising.
Mm-hmm. You know, you are always warned about the danger of films. Did any of that come back to you after this?
No.
Not relevant.
I think art really works, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it is possible through artifice to, vicariously purge yourself of these dangerous feelings.
You said that you are no longer the same person who wrote Taxi Driver, that you don't really have those feelings anymore. At that time, I think you were really motivated by certain demons, by alienation, by loneliness. You're now married, you're a father, and I figure loneliness wouldn't have the same pull on you that it did then. Are there different things that motivate you now in your writing, or even different demons that drive you?
Yes, certainly. And you miss those old demons, you know, boy, because those are powerful engines, and they really drive you hard. It was actually easier to write then because you had no choice. You were just running to keep the demons from swallowing you up. So today it's a little more difficult. You have to use your imaginative powers and your creative skills to a greater degree.
What kind of compromise do you feel that you have been or have had to make in your career between writing screenplays that fit your vision, that communicate the ideas that you're interested in, and you really do communicate ideas in your screenplays, and making something that's actually saleable?
Well, I mean, I want to communicate. You know, this is the movie business is the business of mass communication. If you're not interested in mass communication, you shouldn't be in this business. So, you know, whatever your personal visions are, you have to put them in the seat alongside the idea of mass communication. So it's just not possible to say I don't care who sees this movie. I try to think of things in commercial terms. You know, will people want to see and hear this? And so I don't avoid that. However, it is not possible to escape the idiosyncrasies of your own psychology. I remember when I did Cat People years ago, and I said to myself, now I'm going to do a film that is not personal. I'm going to do a genre movie, a horror movie, a special effects film. It's not going to be about me at all. Well, I look back now at that film, I think it's more personal than any of the others.
In what ways?
I just feel that the character of the zookeeper is really me. And when I set out to make the film, I didn't think that at all. So you can't really escape yourself.
Is that considered a liability in parts of Hollywood, that you would put yourself into it and that you would end up putting certain ideas into a screenplay, even unintentionally?
Well, it is a liability. And the fact of the matter is that I do exist sort of on the cusp of the industry. But that's fine with me, you know, as long as I can keep working and doing the films I want. And the industry understands very well that last year's cusp can very easily become this year's center.
Several of your films, like Patty and Hardcore, are in their way about leaving the family and about breaking away, either voluntarily or involuntarily, from what your life has been. When you left your home and when you broke away from the church, was that a wrenching experience for you?
No. I mean, it was more like the way a bullet must feel when it's finally discharged from a gun.
You want to explain that?
Well, I've been waiting a long time to get out of there, and I came out with a bang, you know, and I took off and didn't look back.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.